Welcome to The Collective Voice, a podcast that amplifies issues affecting technical hiring. This episode is the second in a series on diversity and inclusion. In this podcast, Recruiting Daily President William Tencup talks to Don Lowry, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at Nielsen, about the protests which occurred more than a decade ago that became a catalyst for diversity and inclusion initiatives throughout their influential organization. I'm Amanda Cole, Vice President of Utechi, and I'm so grateful that you're listening today.
Tell us your story. How'd you kind of get into this game?
Yep, I am close to commemorating my 15th anniversary at Nielsen. I had started my career as a newspaper reporter and worked in several cities, including Boston, a couple cities in Virginia, and then moved to work in television and public affairs in Boston. Moved and had a three-year hitch working in public finance, investment banking, and followed that by worked for 10 years for the New England Patriots football team as the head of public relations and public affairs.
All right, full stop.
That's
it. Were you there for any of the Super Bowls?
I was there for the first Super Bowl, yep.
Did you get a Super Bowl ring? Do they give... Yep.
I have in my possession.
Oh, my goodness. Do you wear it? I mean, when you're out, like, just going to...
Back to, you know, Patriots event. But it's a, you know, it's a monster thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations. That's fantastic. That's when they started their run. So you were there.
Fun, yeah. That was the first one. So, yep. And I came here.
Right.
After that, and started in at the time, we didn't have a D&I operation. What I was doing was communications and public affairs. So I started here, Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs.
And so, in your career, you've kind of seen diversity and inclusion in a lot of different, from a lot of different vistas, a lot of different viewpoints.
Yep.
So let's start there. When you first got to Nielsen, there wasn't kind of a true D&I position or things like that. How has that evolved? Take us through that ramp and that the changes that have been made and kind of where you are now, right now with D&I.
Yeah. So you were right. We had absolutely no formal D&I operation when I came to Nielsen. In fact, there wasn't anything even in HR.
That was
designed to promote diverse employment within the company. So probably Crystal, Andrea wasn't here when this all happened, but maybe Crystal related this to you, that this really started our D&I journey, as I call it, started as a result of some objections that we were facing when we were changing the methodology that we did for measuring local television. We had stopped using the written diaries that had been traditional for Nielsen for many, many years. And then we went to electronic measurement. And there were some community organizations in concert with News Corp who were protesting whether or not our ratings actually reflected communities of color. So they literally came to our offices and launched a pretty massive effort to try to get us to stop rolling out this methodology until we address this issue. So we responded that we didn't necessarily accept their premise that we didn't accurately measure communities of color, but as we examined what we were doing, it was clear that we were not doing anything near what we should have been doing to help the broader community, and particularly communities of color, understand who Nielsen was, what we did, how we collected the information we collected, and why we use it. So really launched the D&I effort, which has expanded. It's almost a different universe from where it was when we started.
why would, just so the audience understands, why would people care? I mean, you're hit with community organizers and people protesting and probably stuff outside the office, etc. Why is it important? Why is it important now, but even back then, why would so many people care?
Well, it's fairly simple that, you know, our business is measuring the behavior of consumers. Mm-hmm. We connect the buyers and sellers, primarily buyers and sellers of advertisers. Obviously, there are other businesses that we do to just involve some measurement of consumer behavior that doesn't directly connect advertising. But our main business is connecting the buyers and sellers of advertising. Those buyers and sellers of advertising look at the information that we provide to make decisions about what programs that they're going to advertise on, and in fact, what programs are going to be produced. So if they see the information that Nielsen has, and there is a lack of diversity or actually accurately reflecting communities of color, say there was an undercount of African-Americans or Hispanics or Asians, their decisions about what programs they're going to produce and then where the advertising dollars are going to be spent won't be accurate. And it won't reflect what the actual impact is of communities of color. So that is the argument. And it's a legitimate argument that if we don't represent any community, communities of color, gender, we've expanded, you know, beyond that into sexual orientation. We've gone to different cuts also to veterans along the way as we've added different demographics. So that's the real crux of this, that we have to accurately measure all audiences. And if we don't, the people in decision-making positions about what media is going to be created mm-hmm. and who's going to see it where is hampered.
That's why, you know, one of my next questions, I was thinking about studios, but they care about your data just as much as the advertisers do, I would imagine.
Well, the studios, you know, who produce for the television networks, the cable networks, increasingly online, they look at our data also. Mm-hmm. So we need to know who's actually watching their programs. They need an accurate representation of who's watching their programs. And that's what we are, that's what we provide our clients.
That's nice. So obviously it started from kind of a place where, I'd say a place of controversy, that's not really correct, but basically community organizers helped you kind of understand that, hey, this might not be going quite the way that it should. You dug into it as an organization. And obviously we know from Crystal's story that it kind of forced the organization to be a little bit more transparent.
Yeah.
Don't know about force, but y'all became more transparent as a result. So where are we?
Go ahead. We are quite open in saying that this touched a nerve and
yeah.
it you know, exposed some things that we should have been paying attention to before. So we're not, and that's one of the good things that has come out of this for I think the entire organization and I think all of our efforts have been made in good faith with the idea of being transparent. There's no reason for us not to be transparent.
Right.
We want people to understand what we do, and we want people to participate in our surveys and our panels. And the more they know about us, the better.
Right. So up where we are now, 2018, about to be 2019. Can't believe it. Where are we going in the next couple of years? Where do you see this transparency and also just D&I?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you never do enough.
Mm-hmm.
We are still working hard to achieve the goals that we have had for several years with regard to employment within the company. Regarding African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. We have hit some of the targets, and we have fallen short a little bit with some of our targets, but it's still happening. We're still committed to doing it, and it's ongoing. And I think that's the same for most companies, to make sure that the people who are working inside the company reflect what the communities look like. So
right.
That's a primary goal for us, and that's, you know, really the primary mission for the D&I efforts, to make sure that our workforce is reflective of the workforce in general in the country. We have more and more connected our D&I efforts with our actual business operations, and Crystal might have mentioned some of that, that we have tried to spread the gospel, if you will, to many of our clients, both advertisers, the television networks, the cable networks, anybody who uses our information. We have tried to spread the gospel about the impact that communities of color are making on the economy. So we want them to understand that African-Americans, Hispanic, and Asians have multi-trillion dollar economic impact in the country. If you're looking to attract those consumers, you need to pay attention to them, and you need to pay attention to their tastes and their habits. And providing them accurate data is the best way that we can do that. So we have more and more moved or made a priority of letting folks see, letting our clients see the benefits of incorporating communities of the interests of communities of color and the data on communities of color in their decisions.
Yeah, nice. It's nice because you're essentially making a business case saying, hey, you don't have to do it. You know, if you don't want to, you don't have to do it because it's the right thing or the moral right. thing or the ethical thing. Do it because you're greedy.
Yeah. It's in your business interest to do this thing because there's money and there's untapped dollars out there. And there's still, a lot of sentiment that, this is the right thing to do and we should be doing. I think that, many of our clients do come from that perspective. Let's do this. But I think it gets more serious when they realize that dollars that are out there that they can get. And, their goal is to make money, maximize profits.
Truth.
Incorporate data, it helps them reach their goals.
I know a lot of the traditional sources that would be using your data, but like the advent of all the online, Netflix and Hulu and all of those folks, are they using your data? Oh, it assumes so, but I just want to make sure that
information on the digital space, women, everywhere we go. Netflix is a particular case because they don't actually subscribe to our service like CBS or ABC or NBC or Nickelodeon or any of those cable things. They're a subscriber-based service like Louis. So they're not out there selling advertising. But they do use some of our data to get a picture of what the overall audience is out there. And that's what we measure. There's no company in the world, or certainly in the United States, that has the depth of knowledge about consumer behavior and media consumption than Nielsen. So that's their business. And right. they have to know what's going on. But they don't base their decisions, at least in terms of commercial decisions, on Nielsen ratings because they don't use them on a day-to-day basis. But the digital space has become obviously a big part of our business. All of our big clients and media have digital components, major digital components. You see it every day. It kind of started with us in a big way with CBS All Access, kind of over the top use that's happening. So, and we know from research that we've done that communities of color are early adapters and over-index in the use of digital media. So for those companies that are producing digital products, it's especially important for them to know that fact.
Right. And all the way down to the device level, right? So all the way down to understanding what people are watching, not just content, but where they're watching it.
Yep, absolutely. So, as we see it every day, and I'm sure you see the stories about the cord cutting with particularly among younger people. They're not watching traditional TV, which is true. And that has changed specifically over the last decade and accelerates. So traditional television viewing through those traditional channels is decreasing. But video distribution and video consumption is actually increasing at a rapid rate. People are watching more video. It's just a different platform. So instead of sitting in front of the TV watching an episode of Will and Grace, people are watching it on their phones, they're watching it on their tablets, they're watching it on their PCs, they're watching it on their desktop, they're watching it in many different ways, but they're still watching.
Right.
And that, of course, requires us to as we do, measure all audiences as accurately as we can. And that includes, you know, audience of color.
Right. So two thoughts I wanted to get your take on. Binge TV watching. This kind of happened over the last decade or so. What? Hey, I just wonder, like, what do you think about that? And then, and then from a measurement perspective, how do you measure those things?
Yeah, it's the same way. So if you were, we use the traditional quote-unquote Nielsen family. And that includes people who are single, people with families of, 10, 15 people, it makes no difference. If you are a Nielsen family, we measure your binge watching. So if you're binging House of Cards or whatever, the latest Ozark, or is that Ozark? Yeah, I think that's Amazon, one of the other. Whatever the product you are binging, whatever the content you're binge watching, we actually measure that if you're part of our, panel.
That is fantastic. And is there a business case outside of the media companies and advertisers? Is there a business case for like retailers to pay attention to your data?
Oh, absolutely. And most of our retailers, either directly or through their ad agencies, ours, they want to know, particularly like during the holiday season. You know, this is a big holiday season, and you see all the ads. I would say something anecdotally, because I don't know this in terms of a fact, but I think that if you've seen in the past 5 to 7 years the change in the families that are depicted in the holiday advertising, it's really remarkable. You know, you see families of color much more often. You see biracial, interracial families that are in these spots. You see LGBT actors and families that are depicted in these spots around Christmas time. So the advertisers do pay attention. They have other data that they use.
Sure.
They have internal marketing data, but our data, you know, reflects what's going on in the country. And what's going on in the country is that the country is becoming more diverse, and therefore the audiences for video and video consumption are more diverse.
So let's dig into that. I mean, my heritage is kind of like three prongs. One from Virginia, for the founding of Virginia, founding of Texas, and one branch would be the Trail of Tears, one of the Trail of Tears. So Native American, and two that kind of go back to England, if you will. So I'm Heinz 57. I'd assume
Yeah.
Right. So how do you slice the data? Like, I almost start like African Americans.
Yep.
How do you, cause it's more diverse.
Yeah. Right, so when we start the process of, and I will go into that whole process if you want, but I'll just give you the 40,000 foot overview. We have the home addresses of every household in the United States to the degree that you can, because that's what we measure, households, household viewing. So when you see the Nielsen ratings, those are estimates based on household viewing.
Right.
So when we reach out to you, you know, first through mail, then through direct contact with your household, we use the methods that are standard in the census, is that you personally identify who you are or not identify. So if you want to identify yourself as Caucasian, you want to identify yourself as African American or Hispanic or Asian or mixed race, or if you care not to, that's how we measure. So we say that this person has identified himself as other, right? You're not African American, not Hispanic, not Asian American, but in most cases, people still generally identify themselves as, you know, Caucasian, non-Hispanic, white. Those are interchangeable, African American or Black or Asian American. And then we also have the Native American. We do measure Native American populations also. So once you identify yourself and you're part of our panel, when that data is reported and we compile it, we let our clients know. We give them the breakdown, not only of racial and ethnic identification. We do it by gender, we do it by age, we do it by income, we do it by household size, and there are another half a dozen slices of how we give our clients the measure of who's watching what programs when, including time-shifted viewing if people are recording it to watch it later.
Mm-hmm. Any pressure either internally or externally to go deeper or slice it, on one way or the other, but making it more granular? Do you feel that pressure?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if it's pressure. You know, it's beneficial to us. I think that over the 3 or 4 years with the LGBT community, we've done a lot of work with the Human Rights Project and we've issued these reports on the viewing of LGBTQ communities. That, and again, I wouldn't call that pressure. That was us working cooperatively with those communities. They came to us. They provided us great insight about how we should go about reaching out to those communities and how we should do measurement. And that's beneficial to our clients. If our clients know that here's this audience that has distinct taste and habits when they consume media and what products that the client should be advertising, that's helpful to them. So the more granular or the more specific that we can become, the better off we are and the better off our clients are. It helps them make money.
Right. So the demographic stuff, I totally understand. The psychographic stuff that might or might not be important or might not come up, like members of PETA or gun owners or people that are more religious or members of Sierra Club or something like that. Like, do you find, again, I use the word pressure and that's not the right word, but do you feel like the advertisers want to know that stuff as well?
Well, in terms of our daily ratings, those are not questions that we ask. So we don't ask people in our overnight ratings, either nationally or locally, are you a member of PETA or are you a gun owner, et cetera, et cetera. Clients do occasionally ask us to do, we call them custom surveys, to find out specific things about our audiences. And we do that, but that's not our, you know, that's not our primary business. There are a lot of companies that do that, by the way.
Right.
Do kind of survey work to survey audiences throughout the country. And they don't have to specifically be tied to, you know, to television viewers here, you know, a survey that's being conducted by PETA, for example, to find out the attitudes of households about animal rights, et cetera, et cetera. So that happens. And obviously, if those entities want to combine the data they have, that happens. They can use that to help understand what the attitudes of members of organizations or the general public, but that's not our primary business.
Right. You see why it's important, see why they do it, just so they can go narrowcast and go even further into an area. Let's go back to kind of your D&I, not just the history of kind of the firm, but just the way that y'all look. You've looked at an audience in a way of saying, hey, listen, let's make sure that we're always representing people in the best way that we can. And that's probably, I would assume that's not necessarily a destination. That's a journey that you're always, always changing and always kind of adapting. How do you turn that inward? In terms of, you've talked a little bit about employees and probably even recruiting and promotion and things like that, but how, A, don't want to make any assumptions there, but let's talk a little bit about that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that effort I told you that we started 14 years ago with regard to the outreach to external communities of color primarily, actually had an impact internally also. So our attitude was, we can't give the best picture of what's happening to people throughout the nation if we don't have people inside of our company who are actually looking like the people across the nation. So we had to do some examinations internally to say, okay, our workforce should look like the workforce of the United States. And as I said before, we know through back in, you know, starting 14, 15 years ago, we were underperforming in our employment picture almost across every ethnic racial group. We're underperforming with African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. So we have made numerous steps and taken numerous efforts to try to make sure that our workforce is, you know, looks like the audiences that we are measured. Everything from, you know, how we hire, where we reach out to find folks, programs that we have internally to promote career development of people of color, and all types of partnerships that we have with organizations outside of the company to make that happen.
Right. And I'm guessing the goal, again, journey, is to go from the board to entry-level positions. Like, everything you'd wanted is, you know, as diverse as you possibly could.
Yeah. And, you know, we have done a great job with entry level. And I think we are probably reflective of what you probably have found in the quote unquote tech industry, because we are in many ways a technology company more and more. We find, you know, great success on the entry level. The difficult part for us, and the thing that we've got to break through in, you know, shortly, as soon as we can, is in the higher levels of management. So from vice president above to, you know, senior vice presidents to executive vice presidents to, you know, we hope, you know, department heads and leaders, we have, you know, we're not where we need to be. And it does not reflect the, you know, the true picture of the population in the country. So I don't know if Crystal and Andrea mentioned to you, so one of the things that we've done internally, and we started 5 years ago, we call it our Diverse Leadership Network, DLN, and it's an 18-month program internally where we select, or managers select, high potential people of color or employees of color and women. And we've done it on sexual orientation also. And those folks have an intense experience learning a lot about all aspects of the business. And the goal is that they eventually will reach senior management status within the company. And we monitor their progress. We make sure that they have outlets to, you know, to tell us the issues that they're facing as they're trying to reach their career goals. And it's been tremendously successful. The retention level is over 90% of the folks who participate in that. But that's one small, you know, one small program of efforts that we do. But it's been, you know, definitely successful.
So with this approach, and I mean, again, it's like a, you've self-reflected and said, okay, we got to do a better job of this. And then you put some programs into place, which is really fantastic. How has that affected recruiting?
I think when people see that you are making the effort, and we tell, you know, we have recruits, particularly recruits of, you know, of color, we tell them about the various D&I efforts that we make. They are interested in it. I do think it is attractive. I think it makes them feel comfortable that they're coming into a place that is promoting diversity and encouraging diversity and providing opportunities for advancement for diverse associates. So it's an important part. It's an important component that we have. And we see it, you know, throughout our recruiting efforts, whether it's on campus or, if, you know, whatever methods we do to recruit, people ask about it. They're concerned about it. And it's not just people of color, by the way, who are concerned about diversity.
Right. It's
larger audiences, wider audience that ask us, you know, what's Nielsen like for, you know, for handling and promoting diversity, gender diversity also within the company. So it's gone beyond simply the you know, ethnic and racial diversity. It's extended to wider communities.
And folks that are younger, do you see that they care more, care less, or are they about the same?
No question about that. I think that if I look back 6 or 7 years ago, what really stood out was how younger applicants for jobs here were really concerned about volunteerism and corporate social responsibility. And I think in the last 4 to 5 years, we've really seen a lot of concern about being a company that promotes diversity, ethnic and racial diversity.
So the old-fashioned mentor programs.
Yep.
Do you also subscribe to kind of buddy programs or mentor programs? And does that is that a D&I initiative, or is it just a kind of a mentor?
We have had kind of informal mentor programs for probably the last 10 years. So just this fall, based on some research that we did regarding promotion and retention within the company, one of the things that we found associates telling us was that they felt the need to have somebody who can guide them in their career pursuit. So we started a program called My Mentor. It launched this fall. We're calling a pilot program. It's in North America. Anticipated expanding globally, but the idea is to pair each of our senior, not necessarily senior leaders, but vice presidents and above, with younger associates, one who volunteer and are looking for mentors. And we have a specific effort that we've reached out to members of our employee resource groups. The one that I'm executive sponsor are, it's SABLE, that's the African American employee resource group. And we have one for Hispanics and Asians, and have encouraged them to reach out and connect with either people who represent those groups or people who don't, but to find a mentor, if it's not necessarily in your employee resource group, but to find a mentor anyhow. And it started about a month or so ago. That the pilot is, we're calling it a pilot now. We're going to look at it closely, monitor it for the next year, and see how it works.
So I want to know a little bit more about the employer resource groups that you just mentioned. What are those for the audience that doesn't know Nielsen? Like,
right. So the employee resource groups, and I think some companies have similar organizations like this. And this really happened at the very beginning of the effort when we were trying to address the issues about representing communities of color in our business. And we looked internally, and we saw that we were not where we should be with regard to the diversity in our own workforce. So one of the things, and it's a model that has been used often and in the past, but we had not had it at Nielsen until about 13, 14 years ago. We've created, it started with employee resource groups for African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian American Pacific Islanders. So what we did was, have people simply volunteer to, participate in those groups, and it was an affinity group, so it was a kind of collective. So African-American associates got together, and if there were particular issues that they were concerned about, there was a place where they could voice those. And if there were particular efforts that they thought the company should take, they could express that to the leaders of those particular ERGs. So that has expanded beyond the three ethnic and racial groups. As I mentioned, we have the LGBTQ group called PRIDE. ADEPT is for our disabled population. We have SERVE for military veterans who are in the company. We have Mosaic, which has started throughout the world and expresses the diversity throughout the globe, because we are a global company. And we have an ERG called NGEN. So it's primarily directed towards millennials. Mm-hmm. And those organizations, those groups, have really been invaluable to us, because it lets senior management hear about what the concerns are for those particular subgroups within the company, and it provides support. So there are examples that I can tell you when I have had younger associates come to me as a member of SABLE and say, I'm having a problem with a particular manager. They don't understand what I'm doing, or they don't seem to pay attention to me. And we try to address that. And we try to see if there are particular things that the manager should be aware of, and what we can do. And one thing that's happened over the past couple years, we've realized that so many of our managers, particularly middle managers, don't have the exposure of working with associates of color. Mm. So they come from, there's nothing against them. They come from backgrounds of colleges and universities or the professional workforce where they didn't have very much contact
right.
with anybody of color. So we have done online tutorial courses and webinars that we've had to that we've conducted to help managers understand how they can be better managers by responding to and understanding communities of color and their associates of color.
So two things. One, I didn't hear that you said something about, and then you probably have a different program for it, but women in leadership.
Yeah. Women win. W-I-N.
W-I-N.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you think you'll live long enough to see maybe a group, an employee resource group for just Caucasians?
You know, I think, first of all, everybody is encouraged to be a member.
Right.
Any of our ERGs along the way. So many of our ERGs have members who are Caucasian. I'm sure every one of us, every one of our ERGs have members who are Caucasians. The ERGs were created to address what was a very clear need that we were not as diverse as we could. So we didn't right. have a number of African Americans or Hispanics or Asians in the company. We weren't paying attention to the needs of disabled. I wouldn't say it was negligence. It's just that we didn't put that as a priority. We didn't do
right.
it. We have particular needs for millennials. Millennials are different than people like me. So we've tried to address all of our employees comprehensively. The racial and ethnic parts of that D&I effort were specifically to address those problems. So if there are issues, and I think that for, say, non-ethnic associates or employees, they traditionally go through the regular kind of routine, the regular role, that if they have issues or their concerns or their initiatives that they would like to take, they pretty much have the opportunity to do that and for the most part feel unencumbered by that.
Right.
That's
right.
Not the case with communities of color and then those sub-organizations that I mentioned. So specifically answering your question, I think now that considering that we do have all of these different ERGs that are all inclusive, we think it's better for non-ethnic employees because we know what the workforce is going to look like.
Right.
And it's changing now. It's different than it was 10 years ago. And you've heard the statistics as I've heard them. In the next 20 years, we're going to have a majority-minority mm-hmm. country. So those managers and those associates going to have to work in an environment that's very diverse. So we think that we're preparing our overall workforce for what the future holds by incorporating the different ERGs that we have.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I've been doing a bunch of research on Gen Z, the recruiting of Gen Z, and how vastly different it is from the recruiting of millennials. Gen Z is the oldest being 22, 23-ish. Almost everything about them is different because this is the first group that didn't live in a world where there wasn't the internet.
Yep.
And so touch computing and voice computing, all this kind of stuff. So it's going to be really interesting. That'll be yet another group that we'll have to kind of figure out.
Well, things that we are, and you mentioned the mentoring program. One of the things that we talked about when we developed the mentoring program is that mentoring is a two-way street.
Right.
And one of the things that we're encouraging our mentors and mentees to do, the younger associates that we have are much more aware of the technology that that the country in general is using, the consumer is using, as opposed to somebody like me who did not grow up in that world and had constant digital interaction, if you will. Both socially and in the workplace. So one of the things that we're encouraging that is, those groups of those people come together in that mentor-mentoring relationship. Let's talk about, how you guys are using social media, how you interact in social media, or how you're using some of the digital tools at work that, for someone like me, those tools didn't even exist, 5 years ago. So, and that's a good thing. I'm interested in seeing how that's going to work out.
Yeah. Mentorship, and again, you've had a wonderful career. Is it better to work with people and mentor people that are like yourself, or is it better to kind of have mentors that are different than you? Like I'm trying to figure out, is it better to already kind of have a kind of a bond, already kind of see each other kind of in the same way, or is it better to have someone that just doesn't have any, can't relate, but that's a good thing, because it's going to be kind of you're going to be teaching them things about yourself. So what's your take on kind of same versus different?
I think it depends on the individuals.
Got it.
So you have people who have mentor and mentor relationships, and it's specifically because they want to learn more or be supported in their business area, right? So if there's a somebody who's a coder and they want to, hey, here's this person who's a senior vice president, and they're responsible for managing all of our employees who do coding, then that is a specific need that person has, and he wants to follow that. Most of our mentees really are interested in learning about how to navigate a career. You know, how do you go about, establishing yourselves within a company like Nielsen? What do you need to do to develop your skills, both professional and personal skills, some life skills that are also part of the mentor relationship. So depending on, and that's one of the things that we ask in the survey, when we ask the mentees, what are you looking for? Are you looking for someone in your specific discipline to help you and support you area, or are you just kind of looking for a general mentor-mentee relationship? I think that that's a good thing to have.
Yeah.
I think it's better for both folks. And some people as mentors are more comfortable with, the people who are specifically tied to their areas. And then some people would rather work kind of on a general basis to support career development. So it really does depend on the individual. But I do think that one lesson I've learned in being involved in mentorship relationships here for some years is if you know from the outset what you're trying to do, it's better for both parties. So if you're on the same wavelength, I think you'll get more out of it.
I like all of them, actually, because I like to self-identify. Hey, you choose both. That's both sides, and I love the take of have a goal. Let's not just have breakfast together, which is great.
Yeah.
But what are we trying to achieve?
What you want to accomplish? That's essentially
savvy. So I got three things left. One is your favorite inclusion story, and it can be with Nielsen or otherwise, but just your favorite story of inclusion.
Well, I think that, and I would almost be a composite. There are, in my own personal experience, it probably a half a dozen cases when we've had people who were having issues that people of color were having issues, and they needed someone to bounce an idea off of, and they do. And it's happened to me specifically, but it's happened to other folks. And based on that relationship, they decided to stay at Nielsen. We did something 3 years ago. It was the first time we did it. It was an African-American employee summit. And we had 280 of our high potential or high achieving African-American employees. We worked together for 2 days in Atlanta for a program where we learned more about the business, had presentations from all of the leaders, and not only anecdotally, but we did some follow-up surveys after we finished that. And there were literally dozens of African-American associates who said, I was getting ready to leave Nielsen, but after this summit and what I learned from the summit, I've decided to stay.
That's amazing.
So it was truly impactful for lots of folks.
What's great is it creates buy-in. I mean, the more you do stuff like that, the more you include people. And you kind of bring them to the level and say, hey, listen, this is what we're trying to achieve. We need your help.
That's good.
Now they're hooked.
Yeah. actually care about me and you care about my career. I'm not just some amorphous figure who's toiling away somewhere else. So that is the best inclusion story that I have. That's a larger one, but it's reflective in a lot of individual encounters I've had.
Right. So back, I would assume this is basic, but I do want to ask it about suppliers, because, you know, you look at your audience and you say, okay, they're diverse. We need to make sure that we're, you know, mirroring what's going on there, employees doing the same thing. I would assume that this extends to vendors and vendor management, and you're trying to be diverse there as well, but probably should ask the question.
No, it's been one of our priorities, and it came from I don't know if Crystal or Andrew mentioned to you our external advisory councils. So what those are is when we were going through the controversy I told you about before, we decided as a result of that to have a group of outside people who were not tethered to Nielsen in any way, who were community leaders, faith leaders, educators, civic leaders, to come and advise us about how we can reach out and be more sensitive to and understanding about communities of color, the three ethnic communities I mentioned before.
Right.
So one of their priorities and one of the things that they really prodded us to get into is paying attention to our supplier diversity activities. I will say that we were really at basically almost zero
when we
started this. And we continue, our goal is still to reach 10%. We did this year, reach 10% of our spend with diverse suppliers, including women. But it's a constant challenge. And
of course,
something we really have to stay on top of, because, you know, a shift in particularly when you're, you know, adjusting, resources within the company, budget shift, budgets change, you really just have to pay attention that you are sticking to that goal with diverse suppliers. And I think it's one of the priorities for our D&I efforts.
Right, right. It's like you become vertically integrated. And so to every audience that we deal with, we're going to now have representative or try our pathway to representative population.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And I said we're proud of where we are, but we know it's always a challenge.
It's funny because you as you've described it, like a lot of folks that are great at D&I, it really isn't a destination. Because the destination keeps changing.
Yeah, it does. And you have to really, because it's one of those things, I said, that there's so many different moving parts in supplying what the company is using, that if you don't pay attention to it on a basis, you're going to fail.
Right.
So try to keep it in mind.
Constant prioritization. Or maybe relentless.
Yeah, it is. And I've seen it. You know, if you don't stay on top of it, it's easy to really. That's not good.
All right. So if I have my math right, you were actually sports information director or PR when both Parcells and Belichick were both at New England.
And Pete Carroll. Yeah.
And Pete Carroll. Oh my God, I'd even forgotten that one.
Yeah.
So I know you. There's stories that you can't tell, and I won't even ask those things. But how different were those three to deal with publicly?
They're completely different personas. I mean, they're, you know, Parcells was kind of the old guard, football coach type, you know, kind of hard edge and always aggressive, and he's always, you know, pressuring people. Pete was different. I think he, you know, they say, quote unquote, he's a player's coach. I don't necessarily think that term is appropriate. I think what he does is that he, you know, when the term now we use for everything is you meet them where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Where Pete, that's his style. He meets the players where they are, and he has a system, he has a philosophy, and those players who can fit in that system and philosophy based on him putting them in a place where they can work with him, they're good. And that's a different style than Parcells. And Belichick's, you know, and his, first of all, I went to school with Belichick.
Oh, my God.
For, you know, I've known him for 40 years. he is, as I said, despite what people think, one, he's got a great sense of humor. He's I wouldn't say he's necessarily a comic or comedian, but he has a great sense of humor. He's a great teacher. That's his great, you know, that's what he does. And his whole thing, and I think this is kind of from the tree that he and Parcells, you know, came from, and they're similar in this regard. Their whole job is put the, you know, prepare the players to be able to handle any situation that they're in, and put those particular players in roles where they can succeed. So if you have a fullback who's a great running fullback and he's not a great pass catcher, then you either teach him how to become a great pass catcher or you don't put him in those situations. And I think it's publicly demonstrated, he just pushes people. And if you can meet the standards, you're in. If you don't, you're not.
Yeah.
So he does not tolerate failure. How about that?
It's funny because I went to Alabama for my undergrad. So obviously Nick Saban is similar. Yeah.
The other two is that, and I guess it's with all coaches, but I think the most successful coaches, that I would put all three of those guys in that category. The biggest thing they can do is identify talent.
Yeah.
And know where it's most appropriate to have that talent to fit in those schemes. I mean, there are hundreds of stories about people who were cast offs in somebody else's organization, and then they came with the Patriots when I was there. I'm looking at Josh Gordon this year, who had problems in Cleveland, and now terrific.
Oh, yeah.
He's been a real asset with the Patriots. Randy Moss.
Randy Moss.
Really his best, you know, career individual year.
You almost wish that Randy Moss would have had 10 years with Tom Brady. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, what would that have been? As time nears, and I'm sure we're boring everyone else with this, but I could talk about it forever. what question should I have asked you that I didn't ask?
I think that you've hit on it and you've said it, and you I don't know if that was something that you've kind of picked up in talking to people about this, but the D&I effort, it really is a journey. It's not, you're not one of the things that when I talk to people about this, I really do emphasize. Do not get depressed or discouraged because you don't see results right away, or there's failure, or there are programs that you do and you started and they don't work. But kind of in new ground, you know, we're breaking new ground in this whole world. And if you really look at it in a serious fashion and in a way that is being incorporated into companies on a large scale, it's really been only 15, maybe 20 years. You know, there were D&I efforts that were made, I call it kind of piecemeal, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but it's really only been in this century that they've become programmatic, and they've had professionals who are working there. So it's a really still young enterprise, and you're going to have failures. We've had lots of failures along the way. We started and we stopped. But that shouldn't stop you from not continuing to proceed. You have to. Accept the failures, learn from them, and do something better, and learn what other people are doing so it can help you. So that's my prophesizing for the evening.
I love it. It's also a great experiment. You know, you're experimenting, trying different things, A, to see if they work, and work in your organization and work for that group of people. So there's a lot of experimentation as well. Donna, I recognize that you're a super, super busy person. I appreciate your time.
Enjoy it, William. If you need more follow-up, please call. And I look forward to, is this going to be part of a single story, or is there a series?
I think there's probably multiple stories that have already kind of started to kind of establish themselves. Because y'all, even though you're speaking about some of the same things, you're speaking about them differently, and so I think as they say in the news biz, this story, there's many legs to this story.
So I'll be curious to see it. Thank you very much, and we'll take care.
All right, bye bye.
Thanks for listening to The Collective Voice. If you or someone you know is interested in a transcript of this podcast or other topics impacting technical recruiting, please visit resources.etechie.com today.